journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, February 28th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Liberation Square, inside the Egyptian Revolution and the rebirth of a nation. We'll speak with journalist Ashraf Khalil, plus a live update on the ongoing conflict in Syria and this week's Civic Circus. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. At least 41 people have died in Syria today, with half of the deaths occurring in Helfaya near the opposition stronghold of Hama. The UN Human Rights Chief called for a ceasefire between President Bashar al-Assad's forces and Syrian rebels. At least 125 people were killed yesterday in Syria, while government officials boasted that their constitutional reform referendum passed with overwhelming support. Al-Assad's regime put up a new draft constitution for approval through a referendum vote on Sunday in response to domestic and international calls for reform. The government reported the referendum was approved by 89% of voters, with over half of eligible voters participating. Reforms included allowing political pluralism and establishing term limits on the presidency to 2 7-year terms. At least 55 people were killed while voting took place on Sunday, and the United Nations and Syrian dissidents have called the vote an exercise in political theater that will produce no tangible change. A UN spokesman told reporters a referendum must take place in conditions free of violence and intimidation, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called it a cynical ploy. Meanwhile, Syria's strongest international supporter, Russia, characterized al-Assad's effort as, quote, an important step on the path of reforms. The European Union on Monday stepped up efforts to force the Syrian government into a ceasefire through sanctions. Al Jazeera reports that 27 countries banned the purchase of diamonds, gold, and other precious metals from Syria, prohibited cargo flights from the EU to Syria, approved sanctions on the Syrian Central Bank, and froze the assets of some government officials. Elsewhere in Qatar, the prime minister of the tiny Gulf nation said yesterday his government was open to arming the Syrian opposition, stating, quote, "We should do whatever is necessary to help them, including giving them weapons for self-defense." The year-long government assault on civilians in reaction to the Syrian uprising has left an estimated 8,000 people dead, and the killing continues with no end in sight, as the al-Assad regime has made no commitment to a non-violent resolution. My guest is Joshua Stacker, assistant professor of political science at Kent State University. He specializes in the politics of Egypt and Syria. Welcome to Uprising, Joshua.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So first, let's talk about the ongoing violence amid this referendum, this constitutional referendum. What do you make of these numbers that 89% of voters approved this constitution, this reform constitution, with over half of eligible voters participating? And do you think that draft constitution itself is enough to foment a positive change in Syria?
Absolutely not on both counts. Obviously, the turnout results in these elections or in any of the elections that we've ever seen under these types of regimes have always been bogus. But that said, that doesn't mean that there isn't a power to the spectacle that the regime put on yesterday. This wasn't about winning over people that detest it or are against it or fight it, willing to go into the streets to fight it. It was about reassuring or shoring up its sort of pockets of support, which I would guess are larger than most of the international media would admit at this stage. They want to paint this as a sort of society that's on the verge of collapse or on the verge of overthrowing this solidly strong authoritarian regime. But I think that what the real message of the fact that they can even pull off a referendum goes to show that they still enjoy some support.
Well, how widespread has the opposition become and also the government's attacks on it? We hear of the one of the central areas of the or focal points of the conflict being in the city of Homs, and yet the violence just over the last few days has occurred in a number of cities. Is this spreading?
Well, I think that the violence that the protesters and the government are engaging right now is only going to widen. And you know, when you have governments like Qatar, which are calling for the civilians to be armed or for there to be arms pumped into this, I mean, what you're doing is creating a larger problem because you're never going to be able to get this sort of heavy artillery to the rebels to fight off those regimes. So you're going to leave citizens fighting an army, essentially. And I think that what we're seeing is a lot of political learning by the opposition at the moment. They were not very coordinated when the armed uprising began, but with each month that passes, they're getting a little bit more savvy, they're getting a little bit more specialized. And at the same time, the longer this goes on, even though the government has weapons, even though the government has an army, we're seeing more and more logistical problems come from the side of the government. So I'm not necessarily saying that what we're seeing is a society and a state that are going to eventually square off in some, big showdown at the OK Corral. What I'm actually saying is that I think that we're watching, a very slow deterioration of this regime and with an ascendant opposition, and these may pass in the night without ever actually meeting. But we're going to wake up one day and the opposition will, be able to outflank and outpace the Syrian state.
What role are sanctions playing? The European Union has pushed quite hard on sort of multifaceted sanctions. Are they playing a positive role? Because sanctions can be a tool if wielded properly, but they can also in many ways strengthen the government in power.
Absolutely. I mean, and this is the problem really with sanctions, is you need everybody to be on board with them. And the problem is that there are always countries that are on board. I mean, Lebanon and Syria tend to work pretty well together politically. And as long as Lebanon's open, Damascus will be open for business. And of course, the borders that run along Iraq, just as Iraqi, instability was bad for Syria, Syrian instability is bad for Iraq. So, the Iraqis are, willing to sort of, keep the economy moving in Syria. And then, of course, the Iranians are also have an interest in sort of sanction busting. So I don't think that in this scenario any amount of sanctions is really going to be effective, because the people that are in the greatest position to kind of cut off Damascus from the world are actually enabling its ability to reach out.
And then there's Russia, which is strongly supporting Syria, at least at the United Nations.
Yeah, absolutely. But, unfortunately, the Russian position doesn't have very much to do with Syria. In my field research in Syria and the time that I've lived in Damascus and traveled around extensively, I mean, it's not like a sort of massive Russian presence. It's nothing comparable to the United States presence in Egypt, for instance, right? So, I mean, you don't have large pockets of Russians living there. You don't have, it's not the same level of material support. What I think the Russians, the reasons why they've stayed on board with the Syrians for so long, is that they're actually quite concerned about the expansion of NATO and Europe and the United States in the region and kind of increasing the sort of those powers' reach in the region, right? Because we've already seen, since these uprisings began, a NATO-led mission that was never really authorized, that has led to, the collapse of the Gaddafi regime and sort of more or less a puppet regime in that new state in Libya. So I think that the Russians are primarily concerned with blocking any further Western attempts to kind of knock over regimes and replace them with sort of, puppet regimes that expand sort of Western and American influence.
Let's talk about the attacks on foreign journalists in Syria and what effect they've had in bringing international attention to the conflict there. There were journalists killed, and just this morning we're getting reports that a French journalist and a British journalist who were injured while covering the conflict there have been safely smuggled out of the country, but at the expense of three Syrians who lost their lives helping these journalists get out of there. We often tend to focus exclusively or perhaps disproportionately on foreign journalists and foreigners who are trapped in these countries where the conflicts are happening at the expense of the lives of the citizens there itself. But did the attack on journalists mark a turning point in this conflict?
Oh, I absolutely think it did. And the international media always focus on what happened to their people as opposed to what happens to locals that actually enable those, foreign superstar journalists to operate in these environments. So I absolutely agree. And, I wouldn't say that I would go as far as to say that the Syrian government, intentionally is targeting journalists. But the fact of the matter is, the fact that foreign journalists are starting to die in sort of bombing, shelling, these sorts of things. The fact that it's all happening under the covert sort of cover, right? They have to smuggle themselves into the country, smuggle themselves out of the country. The fact that they're starting to be caught up in these war zones and dying, and they don't have the protection of the Syrian state, that what this is going to do is have a very negative effect, right? Because none of the major media outlets in the mainstream media are actually going to send their sort of high-powered correspondents in. So what's going to happen is actually going to put more of an emphasis on local journalists and citizen journalists to risk their lives to get the story out.
Joshua Stacker, let's turn to the notion that the Syrian opposition is itching to be armed by a number of outside countries. I mentioned Qatar earlier, but also the UK, it's being reported, is strengthening its ties to the Syrian opposition, particularly the Syrian National Council, that they have officially now recognized as a legitimate representative of the country. What does that mean, and what do you know of any official arming of the Syrian opposition by outside governments?
I mean, right now, I don't think that the official stance, at least the international consensus, is not to arm the Syrian Free Syrian Army. Governments and powers say things all the time that they don't actually follow through on. So I think that there are weapons being smuggled in, and I think that there's sort of more creativity by sort of Western governments to get these sort of weapons in. I mean, if humanitarian intervention is not enough to persuade people to persuade your citizens to allow you to intervene in a conflict that you really don't have much of a humanitarian interest in, then what you have to do is you have to manufacture violent conflict so that you do have a stronger case on so that you can intervene. So what I'm saying is it doesn't really matter what everybody's stances is on, it's this. Everybody doesn't want the weapons to go in there and arm this sort of Free Syrian Army, but we know the weapons are getting in anyway. So if we trace the links, what we're going to find out is that, the parties that are saying that they don't have an interest in intervention are actually helping arm the rebels so that there becomes a reason for intervention.
And so you foresee that there's going to have to be, or there inevitably will be, some kind of foreign intervention?
Inevitably, that might be too strong of a word, but I think that foreign armies, and of which, I mean, the Middle East is exceptional in this respect. There is no other region that has as many foreign armies traipsing around it, knocking over its regimes in the world. So my sense is that foreign armies, and particularly, the United States Army, is in the business of regime change and nation building in the Middle East, despite their incredibly poor record of being able to accomplish such tasks. And so I cautiously always assume that Western powers are interested in intervening.
Well, Joshua Stacker, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
I want to thank you, too. It's been a pleasure.
Joshua Stacker is an assistant professor of political science at Kent State University. He specializes in the politics of Egypt and Syria. We're going to continue our focus on the Middle East after this week's Civic Circus with journalist Ashraf Khalil discussing his brand new book, Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Civic Circus. I'm Ankur Patel, breaking down local politics. Going to three-hour meetings so you don't have to. This week on Uprising, I'll cover Move LA's fourth annual transportation conversation. The title of this year's conference, held at Union Station, was LA on the Verge of a Transit Breakthrough. Move LA is the organization that was able to get Measure R approved by 68% of voters, Measure R being the half-cent sales tax increase that will provide billions of dollars to fund transportation and is now intertwined with the 3010 initiative in Los Angeles County. Move LA prides itself on being a robust coalition of important political communities in Los Angeles. The program for Friday's conference at Union Station was packed with consultants, developers, elected officials, and other special interests, all of whom seemed eager to grab a piece of the transportation funding pie. While the organization's attempt to raise funding for new transportation projects in LA are worthy and relevant, what I found missing was the basic conversation of how poor people get from A to B most efficiently. Multiple state assembly members, a state senator's chief of staff, a mid-level staffer from Senator Barbara Boxer's office were just a sprinkling of the politically influential folks recognizing transportation as a potentially nonpartisan issue. Perhaps in a testament to the special interest, the Move LA conference was a politically sophisticated event as the heads of politically influential organizations like Gary Tobin, president and CEO of the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce, and Maria Elena Durazo from the LA County Federation of Labor were part of a message that included putting direct phone pressure on six specific California Republican congressmen that are holding up transportation funding. Representatives from unions like the IBEW sat on the same panel as an executive from AECOM, which, among other things, builds prisons. Also on the same panel were representatives from the Natural Resources Defense Council and other nonprofits offering input on the fringes of the conversation. What really boggles my mind is the fact that these blatantly blue politicians are talking up regressive taxation to fund these projects, which means poor people would pay a higher percentage of their income than rich people to fund these transportation projects. Now, I'm against raising taxes altogether when the largest chunks of tax money goes to funding riot police, the surveillance state, or employing bureaucrats and lawyers. What is needed, in my opinion, is greater efficiency in spending the money we already have. The academic and political focus at the Move LA conference ended up skewing the conversation to the point where a question regarding transportation apartheid and the classism that does exist in Los Angeles was answered with, "We need a better, more connected transportation system so that the rich people are incentivized to use public transit." Thank you for that. This is in direct contrast with what we see every day, and most recently with the proposed cut of MTA Route 305, a line that gets poor people of color from South LA to work in Westwood. At the same time, Move LA talks about getting billions of dollars in tax revenue through policy. The MTA is cutting 300,000 hours of bus service to save $23 million. Now, instead of discussing gentrification, the catchphrase was transit-oriented development. Instead of down-to-earth decision makers, we get suits flying in helicopters telling us where the buses should go. For Uprising, I'm Ankur Patel with Civic Circus.
Thanks, Ankur. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. The 18-day Egyptian revolution captured the world's attention just over a year ago, but media blackouts and the narrow scope of news coverage here in the U.S. resulted in few candid real-time accounts of events by Egyptians on the ground. In his remarkable new book, Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation, Egyptian journalist Ashraf Khalil recounts the chaotic days of the revolution in vivid detail. In describing the mood and events on the pivotal Day of Rage protests on January 28, 2011, just 3 days after the revolution began, Ashraf Khalil relates an exchange he had with one protester. As the two were enveloped in tear gas and facing a violent onslaught of Egyptian security forces, the young man, raw with emotion, told the journalist, "I expect the government to fall today. There will be dead bodies in the streets. I have nothing to lose anymore. I have a degree in information technology, and I've been sitting at home for the past 3 years." Intimate exchanges like this make Khalil's Liberation Square an exclusive account of the movement that inspired the world. His book transports readers to the streets of Cairo, alongside protesters chanting for the end of Hosni Mubarak's reign, and into Tahrir Square as demonstrators camped out and fought against central security officers. In addition to a bird's eye view of the action, Khalil takes the reader back 30 years to recount the series of events that allowed Hosni Mubarak, who Khalil calls the accidental dictator, to take power. In Liberation Square, Ashraf Khalil is an engaging storyteller and an astute analyst as he traces the rise of Mubarak, the decline of Egyptian society, and the small acts of resistance committed over many years that culminated into the 2011 revolution. I had the chance to sit down with Ashraf Khalil just recently to discuss his book while he was visiting Los Angeles. And I asked him to begin by telling me about how Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, actually became so hated by his people. But before I go to the clip of that interview, I want to remind you that we are in the final home stretch of KPFK's fund drive. And at the end of this week, I'm going to be celebrating 10 years on KPFK. And on Sunday, March 4th, will be the 10th anniversary of my very first broadcast on KPFK. And I'd love to have you there. So I'm inviting you today to join us for a fundraiser for KPFK to mark my 10th anniversary at the Kingston Cafe in Pasadena, 333 South Fair Oaks Avenue, on Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. Tickets are $50 a head. If you pledge $100 and get two tickets to the party, we'd like to give you a free copy of Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation by my guest, Ashraf Khalil. In your book, you write about how, in many ways, Mubarak's ultimate crime, you say, will be treating his people with contempt. He wasn't like Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
I should mention he played an interesting role during the 1991 Gulf War, which also was a turning point in the way his fellow Egyptians saw him.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about how he managed to slowly begin inspiring the ire of his own people, but not with big dramatic ways, not with the mass graves that Iraqis had to deal
with.
This
is one of the things that, during the revolution, I would have editors asking me these questions, and I would say, look, bottom line, there's not going to be revelations of mass graves in Egypt. It wasn't that kind of dictatorship. You know, and I think I've got a line in there that says that as modern dictators go, he might not crack the top 10.
Mm.
It was a different kind of a place. It was more subtle than that. And as I as you said, I regard one of his crimes as sort of overseeing this collapse of Egyptian pride in themselves and self-respect and this feeling of helplessness just became so entrenched under Mubarak that his reign, I think, really had a very corrosive effect on Egyptian society and psychology. It wasn't the direct violent traumas inflicted by Hafez al-Assad in Syria, by Saddam Hussein, by a whole host of others. It was more this long-term effect of helplessness, of teaching his people that their opinion didn't matter and that kind of they didn't matter. I remember very well a protest I covered in about 2000. It was about Israel and Palestine. There was new action somewhere. Something was happening. Second Intifada was kicking off, I'm sure. And I saw a group of young students being chased down the street by riot cops with billy clubs, not like right around the corner from my house in Cairo. And I'm watching this with store owners on the street. And I asked the shopkeepers, like, what do you think of what you just saw? And he said, if we had any dignity, we would be with them.
Mm.
In that people felt strongly about things, but they just felt helpless. They were taught, it was kind of ingrained in the Egyptian personality at that point. The phrase in Egypt is imshi gembel heta, walk next to the wall. And that's code for mind your business, feed your family, don't involve yourself in affairs of governance that are above your station. And that's kind of – that really got corrosive during the Mubarak era. It was this combination of helplessness and having no trusted societal arbiters, no uncorrupted national institutions. The police became this predatory force. The judges, small claims court, et cetera, you couldn't really trust them. If there was a dispute between you and I, a business dispute, there wasn't – who would we go to? There wasn't anyone we would trust to arbitrate the dispute. So it became this battle of wasta, of connections, of who's your uncle, who's my uncle, who knows who in the presidency, who knows who in the governor's office. And it just became – so Mubarak's – the long-term effect of Mubarak's reign, it really spread cynicism. It spread self-loathing almost.
Well, you brought up the riot cops, and the interior ministry in Egypt under Mubarak is an important part of the story as well. And ultimately, even if Mubarak may not have been directly controlling how the ministry conducted the security forces on the ground, it became a sort of manifestation or symbol of his dictatorship. Tell us about How that even evolved, how these security forces became to be this very controlling force on the streets, and also who the security forces themselves were comprised of.
I point to somewhere in the mid-90s as a turning point in the relationship where the interior ministry, when a new interior minister came, if you'll recall, in 1997 was the Luxor massacre, which was a huge blow. You know, Islamist gunmen took over, basically killed several dozen tourists at a temple in Luxor, Egypt, and it was horrific, and it was a huge black eye. It was for the Egyptian security forces and a nightmare for Egypt in terms of tourism. And after that, a new interior minister came in, and I think things sort of changed after that. In that there was just the handcuffs were off at this point. They were free to do whatever they wanted, no questions asked, and the government, there was no oversight. There was no way to weed out a bad officer. There was no one to take a police brutality case to, and you just had this blanket dedication to the cover up. You know, they would unify. No matter what the police brutality case, no matter what evidence you had against a police officer, he would be backed by the government and by the full force of the government, which means he'd be backed by the coroner. He would be backed by the case would go to a compliant judge, et cetera, et cetera. And the long term effect of that really did the police became kind of predatory, I think. And the last thing you would ever want, you never went to an Egyptian police officer for help in those last 15 years. You just wanted them to leave you alone. They brought nothing good into your life. And at the same time, on a higher level within the Interior Ministry, an organization called Mubahis Emn al-Dawla, State Security Investigations, became dominant. The new Interior Minister who came in after Luxor, Habib al-Adli, was the former head of state security. So when he became interior minister, they became this monolith, this ministry within the ministry. Mm. And state security, those last 15 years, was into everything. The newspaper editors, college deans, college professors, syndicate elections, and to say nothing of street level politics and parliamentary elections. You needed to get a sign off from Emn al-Dawla, from state security, to do almost anything. They were this octopus. And I think that became symbolic of the way things went in those last 15 years under Mubarak. Mm. And really, I do think it was failure to rein in the police forces that brought him down. I think, there was an iconic case of a young man named Khalid Said in Alexandria, June 2010, who was beaten to death by police officers in public and in front of witnesses. And he became the symbol of decades of misbehavior by the police, and not just beating deaths, just casual humiliations, mafia-style shakedowns, tiny little power games and humiliations that happened every day with civilians.
My guest is the Chicago-born Egyptian journalist Ashraf Khalil, based in Cairo, author of the brand new book Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation. I had the privilege and honor to spend an hour with him recently at the studios of KPFK. I read his entire book in a day and a half. I couldn't put it down. It's called Liberation Square, and which of course is the translated name of Tahrir Square. Tahrir means liberation in Arabic, and it's our thank you gift to you today. If you make a pledge of $100 or more anytime this hour, we have 20 copies of the book. It's a hardcover, brand new book to give to the first 20 of you who call in and pledge $100 for a pair of tickets to the 10th anniversary party that KPFK is throwing for me this Sunday, March 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Kingston Cafe in Pasadena. I'm so excited about the party, and I'm so glad to be able to pair the tickets to this party with this book, because my conversation with Ashraf Khalil, I think, is absolutely typical of my experience here at KPFK. It has been such a joy to pick the brains of people like Ashraf Khalil, to read their work, to consume it, and to then transmit it to you in these interviews, in these intimate settings, in these conversations that I hope are just as insightful and educational and joyful to you as they are to me. 818-985-5735 is the phone number to call. 818-985-KPFK. We only have 20 copies of the book in hardcover that have been generously donated by the publisher. And the first 20 of you who call in and pledge $100 or more will give you that copy free. It's an amazing book, and it is perhaps one of the most instructive and readable accounts of the Egyptian Revolution from somebody who was there, who watched it happen, who watched it unfold, who was on the streets, who recounts anecdotes, literally conversations he had with people on the street. The book starts out with a chapter called The Accidental Dictator, where he takes you back 30 years ago to how Hosni Mubarak came to be the president in the very first place, comparing him to Dan Quayle. It's a very entertaining and informative and politically astute chapter. And then how the various protests that built up, including in 2003, when the protests against the Iraq War happened, how those became the first signposts on the way to Tahrir, as Ashraf Khalil describes in Chapter 2. He goes on to discuss Muhammad al-Baradei and the various people on the ground, Khalid Saeed, the martyr, as he was seen, the middle-class youth who was killed by security forces, as well as the Egyptian blogger Sand Monkey, who goes by the name Sand Monkey, Asma Mahfouz, who's the young Egyptian woman whose video call to protest on January 25th of last year turned viral and helped generate so much outrage. It's an amazing story, and it's our thank you gift to you today. This 18-day revolution, which is really part one of a revolution that continues today. 818-985-5735 is a phone number to call for a pledge of $100. We'll give you a couple of tickets to my 10th anniversary party that's happening this Sunday, March 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Kingston Cafe in Pasadena, and we'll throw in a copy of the book. So that's $100 for the tickets and the book at 818-985-5735. I want to turn back to my interview with Ashraf Khalil, discussing how the protests first can be traced back. The first of them can be traced back to February 2003, when global protests were happening around the world against the Iraq War. And we also discussed Tahrir Square and Khalid Saeed.
It's really interesting. It's one of those things that it wasn't until I started to get into the research on the book that I realized what a pivotal moment that was. I mean, just as background, in the build-up to the war, you know, it was a several-month escalation before the U.S.-led coalition invaded Iraq and ousted Saddam Hussein. Mubarak had spoken out publicly against it, saying this is a bad idea. This is going to be a disaster. But people thought that was kind of face-saving and that he was pretty much on board with the project. He let U.S. warships sail through the Suez Canal, basically saying, hey, what can I do? My hands are tied. It's a public waterway. It would be irresponsible. I can't just shut down the Suez Canal. But people thought that he was complicit in what was regarded as essentially an imperialist move. But, you know, I'm speaking from the minds of the majority of the Egyptian population. On the night that the attacks began, March 20th, I believe, 2003, was the first occupation of Tahrir. Protesters overwhelmed security forces and took over Tahrir Square. And it's kind of an underreported footnote in Egyptian history. And I remember seeing this. I was actually in Qatar at the time. I was covering CENTCOM. I was covering the U.S. Military Command Center in Qatar at the time. So I'm watching this on television, and I'm seeing images I'd never seen before of the central security, the riot police on the run, protesters sort of carrying batons and shields and things like that. And they took over Tahrir Square for the first time. And they didn't hold it. They basically held a noisy rally and party for several hours and then went home voluntarily. But so many people pointed to that moment as a crucial moment of weakness by Mubarak, as a moment of ascendancy by the activist forces. One activist that I spoke with a lot, a socialist activist, said that that was the moment when people started focusing internally as well. That it wasn't just after that point there was a strategic decision to not just talk about foreign policy issues. Previously, most of the protests had been about Israel or America. It was foreign policy, not domestic, and a different tone came into the protests after that.
You say in your book, what started with down with America turned into down with Mubarak.
That's a quote from an activist who points to that moment of March 2003 as a point of no return.
Well, let's talk briefly about Tahrir Square. Well, we should talk a little bit more than briefly about Tahrir Square. It's the title of your book, Tahrir Means Liberation.
Yes.
And I want to quote from your book where you say, Tahrir became the epicenter of a revolution. Protesters not only transformed it, they were themselves transformed by their presence in it. Tahrir became a revolutionary organism unto itself, bigger than any one citizen or political faction, and more important, bigger than Mubarak and his government. Why was this geographic space so important? And how did it kind of become its own republic, if you will, as you describe?
It's one of the most amazing things of the entire revolution was just the significance that Tahrir took on. It wasn't the site of protests. 5 years ago, people weren't protesting in Tahrir Square. They were protesting at Cairo University or protesting at the Journalist Syndicate or the Lawyer Syndicate. Those were the hotbeds in Cairo. So it's kind of, you know, Tahrir is sort of the geographic heart of Cairo, but it didn't have real political significance before. This kind of happened on its own. And there is an instinct to, you know, when you have a big crowd, oh, let's take Tahrir, as happened in 2003. But during the revolution, this just happened very organically and very effortlessly. And people knew once they held Tahrir, it really did. They transformed it and they were transformed by it. It was this amazing thing. There was this kind of groupthink in the most positive possible sense of that term, in that there seemed to be this effortless communication among all these protesters of different ideologies, different socioeconomic backgrounds. But once they were in Tahrir, I mean, one of the things that I really fixate on is the first thing the protesters did when they took over Tahrir Square on January 28th, they cleaned it. And you really have to have spent a little bit of time in modern-day Egypt to know how amazing that is, in that people don't really clean up after themselves. There's not a sense of community. There's not a sense of ownership. And I can partially lay that on Mubarak and partially on just people's behavior and a need to kind of like retrain people on the idea of citizenship and living in a community. But the people, when they took over Tahrir Square, they kept it clean. They cleaned it every day. Every time I went into Tahrir Square, the streets there were cleaner than the street outside my apartment in Giza has ever been. And that's powerful. That is meaningful. And it just became – it was just this special place. And I still – you know, as you would walk into Tahrir Square, you would pass through lines of security checkpoints. Individual volunteers, not military. You know, volunteers with badges around their neck would pat you down and check your ID. Multiple redundant levels of pat downs, and they were very thorough and very polite. They would apologize as they did it, but they had a job to do. And as you entered Tahrir, there would be a welcoming line, people clapping and cheering and saying, "Welcome to liberated ground." It really felt like its own organism. And that changed almost immediately after Mubarak stepped down. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things. One of the things I mentioned in the book is that sexual harassment in Tahrir Square was almost unknown during the revolution. And there was a lot of female revolutionaries, a lot of female participants in this revolution from day one. But then people want to ask about Laura Logan. People want to, you know, that was the 11th. On the day that Mubarak resigned, all the unreformed folks got up off their couches and came to join the winning side, and the place changed immediately. Mm. And it wasn't. Laura Logan was merely the most egregious and most publicized example. But, you know, I remember being at a brunch on the day after the resignation with friends, sort of a celebratory get together, and several female friends said, oh yeah, I was in Tahrir last night and it was really intense and nasty and I couldn't stay. And it was so depressing to hear that. It's like, oh God, we're back to that again. Like but it really was, it was a special place. I'm nostalgic for Tahrir during those 18 days. Mm.
And I do want to talk about the aftermath of what happened once Mubarak stepped down. But let's also discuss a little bit of now some of the activist sparks to the revolution. We mentioned Khalid Saeed,
yes,
this young Egyptian, and how he you say Khalid Saeed, this young guy who was beaten to death for what, having hair that was too long.
The reasons are still a mystery. Yeah. I spent a lot of time trying to decide because they went for him.
Right.
It wasn't accidental. He wasn't just walking home and ran across an officer in a bad mood and things spiraled out of control. I spent a lot of time and I realized that when I started doing the book, not many people had actually deconstructed what happened on that day. So I went and I interviewed as many people as possible and all, you know, as many witnesses as possible. Right. They went for him and I still don't know why.
My guest is Ashraf Khalil, who has been covering the Middle East for The Times of London, The Economist, Foreign Policy, The San Francisco Chronicle, The Christian Science Monitor, as well as the Middle East edition of Rolling Stone. He worked as a correspondent for the LA Times in the Baghdad and Jerusalem bureaus. He's been based in Cairo for most of the last 15 years. And we're giving away copies of his book, Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation. For pledge, it's actually a free bonus gift, along with any pledge of $100 or more at 818-985-5735. And for $100, you can get two tickets to my 10th anniversary party happening this Sunday at Kingston Cafe, 5 to 8 p.m. And that's at 333 South Fair Oaks Avenue. Salon calls Ashraf Khalil's book a thrilling account of Egypt's revolution. What's remarkable about Liberation Square is how good it is, how well written, how perfectly calibrated in its amounts of background commentary and prognostication, and above all, how thrilling it is to read. The Christian Science Monitor says Egyptian journalist Ashraf Khalil confounds expectations with an insightful account that feels rich. It is difficult to imagine a better guide to the Egyptian portion of the so-called Arab Spring than Khalil's book, Liberation Square. Khalil offers plenty of wisdom along with action-packed reportage along the way. 818-985-5735 is the phone number to call. 818-985-KPFK. For pledge of $100, you and a friend can come and celebrate KPFK this Sunday, March 4th, and we'll give you a copy of this book, Liberation Square, by Ashraf Khalil. Joining me in studio this morning is Uprising producer Martina Steiner. Hi, Martina.
Hi, good morning. So excited to be here. I'm very excited that it is our last Tuesday before the end of the fund drive, and I'm even more excited that we are having a party on Sunday. And that I get to go and celebrate Sonali being on air for 10 years. And it's just going to be so much fun. And I really wanted to jump on and invite all of our listeners to come to pledge to the station, keep us on the air. For a pledge of $100, you and a friend, family member, fellow lover of Uprising and Sonali can come and join me and Sonali and Teddy, our engineer, you hear his name every day, our interns, and a bunch of KPFK staff at the Kingston Cafe on March 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. It's at 333 Fair Oaks Avenue in Pasadena. You can come join us, party with us. That's what we're inviting you to do. We are inviting you to come party with us, have fun with us, and celebrate this show that's been on the air for 10 years, and celebrate the station that has allowed this show to be on air for 10 years, because you know Uprising, its home is at KPFK. You know that you wouldn't be able to find this anywhere else were KPFK to go away. There would be no other station. People would love to have Sonali, but what we do here on this show, this is only possible because of KPFK. Uprising as it is now, there's no one waiting with open arms to say, you know what, do the kind of journalism you want. Challenge the people you want to challenge. ask those tough questions that you want to ask. Dig into the politics and, you know, everywhere from the federal government, international politics to local politics. Dig into it and embarrass people if you have to. Point fingers, name names, you know, like shake things up a little on your show. Interview those activists that no one else wants to talk to. You know that this is only possible on KPFK, and it's also only possible because Sonali's brilliant. She's amazing at what she does. She works so hard at what she does. So I want to invite you, please, pledge $100. You and a friend come and join us on March 4th, Sunday again from 5 to 8 p.m. in Pasadena. Call 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. Come join us and support the station, please.
And, you know, Martina, I really want to just celebrate the end of the fun drive on Sunday.
Yes, absolutely. It's a fun drive wrap party. You don't know how much fun we are all going to be. We are going to be just...
We're going to be slightly hysterical. And you know, I think you brought up a really important point because it really it's a celebration of the station. The fact that this space allows me to be the journalist I want to be without the editorial chokeholds that so many other journalists face. I mean, of course, within reason. I mean, if I went kind of nuts on the air, the management would get a little worried, as they should. But within the scope of the Pacifica mission, I have complete editorial freedom. You and I, as journalists, Martina, have editorial freedom. And that is very, very unique in the media landscape. So please do join us. The number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. You can get tickets to the party happening this Sunday. There'll be food and drink and music. Teddy and Mark Maxwell are going to be DJing. There'll be surprises. And I'll be there with my family. It's a family-friendly party. Kids under 10 can come in with you without any charge. So if you have a young family, a couple of parents and couple of kids, you just have to spend $100. And remember, it's a donation to the station, although it does cover your food and drink. So do come on over. And if you spend $100 on KPFK this morning, we'll give you a free copy of Liberation Square by Ashraf Khalil, which Publishers Weekly calls compelling, nuanced, and engaging, blends astute observations with reportage of the demonstrations as they unfolded. Khalil's account is essential reading, evoking the urgency and vitality of the Arab Springs Egyptian chapter. The Daily Beast said Khalil illuminating reporting situates the revolt in the stultifying decades that preceded it. He does an admirable job pulling together the threads of the early dissident and activist efforts rooted in the late 1990s. 818-985-5735 is the phone number to call. Join us and celebrate the journalism that has kept you informed. When you are paying attention to what's happening around the world, you know you can turn to KPFK to hear from voices like Ashraf Khalil, whose book, I have to tell you, and I know, Martina, you went through his book as well. What an amazing book. I couldn't put it down. And at the end of the interview, you said, did you read the whole book? And I said, yeah, actually, I did. I couldn't stop.
No, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, I was so engaged with it. You really feel like you are on the streets, you know, just following this amazing journalist around, talking to protesters, getting, you know, just firsthand accounts. And it was those accounts that while we were all reading news stories and even watching TV and hearing from reporters, they're mostly American reporters, they're English-speaking reporters. Like, we didn't really hear straight from the mouths of Egyptians how they were feeling, how they were strategizing, you know, how long they thought it would last, and the resolve of the people that comes through in this book is amazing. And also, again, like Sonali said, who is Mubarak? I mean, he became this larger than life figure, but you don't know that he was an accidental dictator, just like Khalil says. So it's an amazing book, and it's also just worth pledging to have the book. It's worth pledging because you're supporting KPFK.
And, you know, ordinarily we would have given the book away by itself for a $100 pledge, but we're giving you a deal today. We would normally have said $100 pledge for the book, $100 pledge for the tickets, together $200. But today, for a pledge of $100, you get the tickets and the book. Just because it's the end of the fun drive, we want to really up those incentives for you to call. It's a more than 300-page book published by St. Martin's Press just earlier this year, and it's amazing, just an amazing account of what happened on the ground in Tahrir Square and beyond. 818-985-5735 is a phone number to call. 818-985-KPFK.
And, you know, our calls dropped off all of a sudden, so we really need folks to come back and give us a call before the top of the hour. We only have one caller on the line. We have about 10 minutes left, so we really need another 10 of you calling in and supporting We hope you want to come to the party. We hope you want the book. We'd love for you to take, you know, take both as, again, our thank you gifts to you. But really, we need you to step up right now and pledge. Make a pledge of whatever you can. Take the gifts that you want, or just, you know, just pledge for the station. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
And those of you who haven't yet pledged this year or in the past several months, in the past 12 months, you are the ones that we're trying to reach today. I'm so, so excited about this event that KPFK is organizing. And, you know, I really want it to be a celebration of the entire KPFK staff, because I don't work in isolation. I don't, you know, do uprising, you know, by myself here. Obviously, not only do Martina and I struggle every day to put this show together, but we've got Teddy on the board. We've got a small army of amazing interns that for no pay help us out in putting this show together.
They get up really early
for us. We've got Jesse Wood, who supplies us with these amazing volunteers and is sitting right there in the phone room today, totaling up all our donations. There, you know, our general manager, Bernard Duncan, our program director, Alan Minsky, you know, everyone from our webmaster to our music coordinator to our programmers, there's a small army of people, folks in the production room, in the membership department, who are Jennifer Kaiser and Christine Blasdale, all of these people whose voices and whose names you hear on the radio station. These are real people putting the station together, keeping it going day after day, week after week, year after year, only with your help. 818-985-5735 is a phone number to call. 818-985-KPFK. I want to turn back to my interview with Ashraf Khalil, where I asked him how he dealt with the fact that the middle of the revolution, all cell phone and internet access was cut off. Part of Mubarak's strategy during this time was to shut down the internet and cell phone service. What role did that play in a movement that had relied significantly on the internet? And how did you as a journalist deal with not having internet access?
It was interesting because, you know, the internet was shut down on the night of the 27th, which was an amazing move. Like, that was unprecedented. The morning of the 28th, the cell phones go down. And It turned out to not mean anything strategically, because at that point it was too far gone. It was much too little too late. And the protesters on the 28th had very cleverly, they probably saw this coming, and I'm sure it was on the list of possibilities, but a total cell phone shutdown around the country was, wow. I mean, I don't even know the technical details of that. But the protesters on the 28th, basically, there wasn't any need for coordination at that point, because they just said, you know what, after Friday prayers, just protest everywhere, wherever you are, protest and keep going. And, you know, you don't need communication at that point. The effect it had on the ground was amazing. It didn't stop the protesters, and it ultimately didn't stop the journalists from getting their story out. What it did was create this amazing kind of, it's like Cairo became this almost like storyteller, verbal storyteller, oral tradition society for a day or two. You had no idea what was happening anywhere else in the country. Mm-hmm. You had no idea what was happening three blocks away. On the 25th, everybody seemed to be on their smartphone, you know, either tweeting or checking what was happening. When there were deaths in Suez on the 28th in protest, everybody in Tahrir knew it immediately. On the 28th, you had no idea what was happening even across the river. So you had no choice but to fight like hell for whatever patch of ground you were on, and then fight through to the next patch. And I think there was a lot of people that I talked to that theorized that the communications shutdown actually drew more people out into the streets just out of curiosity. And then when they saw what was happening, they joined the protests. Mm-hmm. As a journalist, it was very interesting because, I mean, basically what I ended up doing was on the 28th, that morning, I was interviewed by the BBC. They had sort of a rooftop studio across the Nile from Tahrir. And it was while we were about to go live that everybody's cell phone died. So I was like, by the time I was kind of scared when we went on the air, because that was new. By the end of the day, I cover the protests. By about 6 o'clock, I need to go start filing. One of my clients at the time was the Times of London, so they had very early deadlines. And I basically walked straight back to the BBC and cut them a spontaneous deal and said, I will be your on-air pundit every hour on the hour. I'll tell you everything I've seen. I'll do television. I'll do radio. But I need a desk. I need an internet connection because they had satellite internet. They had their own dedicated satellite internet connection.
So you had to improvise.
So I bartered, basically. I was like, I'll be your pundit. Don't pay me. Just give me a computer.
Ashraf Khalil has been my guest. I sat down with him for an hour discussing his book, Liberation Square, our thank you gift to you today. And of course, we will play that interview in its entirety after the pledge drive is over. But you can get a copy of his book right now at 818-985-5735. It's our bonus thank you gift to you today that goes along with any pledge of $100 or more. If you pledge $200, we'll give you two copies of the book. We have four callers on the line right now, and the books are limited in number. So call us right now. We're probably, in fact, we won't be doing this again. It's not like we're going to be offering these books again between now and the end of the fund drive. So whatever we give away this morning is it. So we just have 4 minutes left in the hour. There's six callers on the line right now. For a pledge of $100, you'll get two tickets to the party that's happening on Sunday commemorating my 10th anniversary. I can't believe it. It's been 10 years on KPFK. Sunday, March 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Kingston Cafe, 333 South Fair Oaks Avenue in Pasadena. The ticket includes food and drink. There's going to be jerk chicken and rice and beans and plantains and wine. And kids are free. Kids under the age of 10 are free. And it's a family-friendly affair. There'll be music, DJing by Teddy and Mark Maxwell. It's going to be a wonderful party. And if you pledge that $100 for those two tickets, we'll give you a free copy of Liberation Square.
It's so rare that the gift that we can offer you is actually hanging out with Sonali.
Ah.
It's rare. It probably won't happen for another 10 years. So you need to jump on this opportunity. Give us a call at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. And for a pair of tickets for $100, you really do just get to hang out with Sonali, party with the rest of the crew, and take away this amazing book, Liberation Square. Really, really, truly is amazing. Again, 818-985-5735. We only have a few more minutes left, and we really need everyone who's been kind of hanging on. Maybe you're parking your car, ready to go into work. Just give us a quick call. Make the pledge.
Just takes a few minutes.
Just takes a few minutes, and we'd so much appreciate it.
We have two callers left on the line right now, and the number is 818-985-5735. 818-983 callers, KPFK. And what I'm also really, really pleased about is that we're able to combine this book with the tickets to the party, because this is such an amazing account. I mean, maybe you remember last year when Mubarak fell. It was February 11th, and February 10th was when he was supposed to resign. Everybody thought he was going to resign. And I discussed this with Ashraf Khalil in his book, and he gave the speech, and everybody was waiting with bated breath, and then he didn't resign. And then it was the next day when the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces announced, right as we went onto the air. Mm-hmm. Remember that,
during
Martina?
Our hour. It was
and
so exciting.
We had like three guests lined up, and thankfully they were already going to be discussing the situation in Egypt.
And we went live to Cairo with
the
guests.
That's right. We played part of the Al Jazeera live feed, which Al Jazeera is now a partner with Pacifica Radio. And it was an amazing, dramatic moment. And if you remember that moment last year, over a year ago, February 11th, 2011, and you thought, thank goodness for KPFK. Call us and make that pledge right now, and we'll give you this amazing book, this account of the Egyptian Revolution, which will make you feel like you were there. And it's such a joy. Whenever I meet people like Ashraf Khalil, when I get the chance to sit down with people like him, and pick his brain and explore his work and the work of other people. To me, that is pure joy. That is the joy of this job. Best job in the world when I get to do things like that and meet people like that. And I really want to share that with you on the air. And we can only do that if you call and support this radio station financially. 818-985-5735. Three callers on the line right now. We can accommodate another five of you at that phone number. Two tickets to the party on Sunday, which is drawing very close. Tickets are limited. And a copy of the book, Liberation Square, out in hardcover, brand new, 300 plus pages by St. Martin's Press. 818-985-5735. We're out of time, folks. For Sonali, subversive thought for the day, B.R. Ambedkar once said, for a successful revolution, it is not enough that there is discontent. What is required is a profound and thorough conviction of the justice, necessity, and importance of political and social rights. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Thanks, Martina.
Thank
Kevin
you.
Kevin Walker is our intern. Teddy Robinson, who's going to be DJing on Sunday, is our engineer. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for pledging. I'll see you tomorrow at 8, and I hope I see you on Sunday.